Hello and welcome to Onk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onk Live On Air is a podcast from Onk Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onk Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Christian Frederick Meyer, MD, PhD, MS, lead medical oncologist for adult patients with sarcoma, and an assistant professor of oncology with Johns Hopkins University. Cardiac angiosarcoma has been in the news ever since the death of acclaimed fashion designer Virgil Abloh in November. Cardiac angiosarcoma is a very rare subset of an already rare disease. Dr. Meyer said that out of approximately 700 angiosarcomas diagnosed in the United States annually, roughly 50 of those will be cardiac angiosarcomas. The disease is difficult to detect in its early stages. Most patients present with advanced metastatic disease and survival is poor. Although most patients receive surgery, there is no standard of care and treatments are borrowed from regimens for other sarcomas. In our interview, Dr. Meyer explains why he sees chemotherapy as a vital part of the treatment regimen for eligible patients and why he believes immunotherapy has the potential to transform care for patients with cardiac angiosarcomas. Thank you for joining us this evening, Dr. Meyer. I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Jason, thanks for asking me to help out.
So cardiac angiosarcoma has obviously been the news because of the recent death of fashion designer Virgil Abloh. But in a very basic sense, what is cardiac angiosarcoma exactly?
Cardiac angiosarcomas kind of fall into a general category of cancers that are known as sarcomas. And those are cancers of what we call your connective tissue. Connective tissue provides a lot of support and structure in your body. They're cells like your muscle cells, your fat cells, your nerve cells, your blood vessel cells. And so when any of these tissues turn into cancer, they're known as sarcomas. And depending upon what cell they come from, we give them specific names. So when blood vessel cells turn into cancer, we typically will call them angiosarcomas. And when these blood vessel cells are located specifically within the heart itself, we call that a cardiac angiosarcoma.
This is obviously for our rare cancer series, but how rare are we talking about with this particular sarcoma?
So in general, there are somewhere between 16,000 and 20,000 sarcomas diagnosed in the United States every year. Of that number, there are probably about 700 angiosarcomas diagnosed every year. And of the 700 angiosarcomas, the cardiac angiosarcomas probably don't make up more than 40 or 50 cases a year.
We're talking extremely rare, though.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of one in a million or less sarcomas.
Have you had the opportunity yet to treat cardiac angiosarcoma in your practice?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have seen a few angiosarcomas. And again, given how rare they are, I don't tend to see more than about one a year. We have had the opportunity to care for some of these people.
With Mr. Abloh, he survived about 2 years following his diagnosis. Is that typical for these patients?
So not necessarily. The difficulty with angiosarcomas, as with other cancers, is that they can hide relatively well and not necessarily produce symptoms until they're advanced in terms of their size and sometimes their spread. Because of that, the average survival of somebody with a cardiac angiosarcoma is typically not longer than a year, maybe a year and a half. So he was certainly outside of those numbers, which are extremely poor for anybody who has any diagnosis of sarcoma. But it was a little bit longer than we typically see.
Why is this disease so hard to spot in the early stages?
I think because it doesn't necessarily produce specific symptoms until it gets big enough to alter kind of blood flow in and around the heart. When the angiosarcoma starts to grow initially, it's not necessarily large enough to produce symptoms like shortness of breath or chest pain or anything like that. As it increases in size, it will sometimes produce shortness of breath because blood doesn't flow as evenly or as regularly through the heart. Sometimes it can cause secondary effects in the heart by causing fluid to build up around the outside of the heart. That's called a pericardial effusion. And that pressure on the heart also affects the way the heart functions. And you notice it by either a very rapid heart rate or shortness of breath.
That typically when patients will begin complaining to their physician that they're experiencing shortness of breath, they're experiencing chest pain. Is that, are those typically the symptoms that cause a patient to begin asking questions?
Yeah, it's typically more along the lines of shortness of breath. And the difficulty is that many, many more common things cause shortness of breath than cardiac angiosarcoma. So there's some degree of trying to rule out the common things being common before necessarily testing more extensively and potentially finding a cardiac angiosarcoma.
How is the disease typically diagnosed?
So usually some specialized imaging is needed. Normally, if someone were to present to, let's say, an emergency room with shortness of breath, they might have a CT scan done, a chest X-ray, and then a CT scan done. Sometimes the CT scan would pick up a mass in the heart, and sometimes it wouldn't. Sometimes what's required is what is called an echocardiogram, which is basically an ultrasound of the heart. So it gives a nice picture of the heart in motion, and that can often identify masses around the heart. Usually, if a mass is picked up that way, then a much more specialized test is then done called a cardiac MRI to look specifically at the heart structure and function and get a better idea of what the mass is. Now, finding the mass is one thing. To actually diagnose it, we typically like to biopsy the masses, although this can prove challenging in people who have masses in their heart. But if we do see a mass in the heart, we do try our best to biopsy it to make sure we have the right diagnosis, because there can be other reasons for masses in the heart that aren't cardiac angiosarcoma.
Once you've diagnosed the cardioangiosarcoma, what's the standard of care?
So that's a very good question, because there's not a straightforward standard of care for cardiac angiosarcoma. I think with most sarcomas, what I tend to tell the patients I see is we put everything in our disposal on the table to look at how best to treat it. We talk about surgery, we talk about radiation, we talk about chemotherapy, and we talk about any other specialized therapies. If it's possible to consider a surgery, then that needs to be part of any treatment plan, because if we can remove the sarcoma, that gives us our best shot at either prolonging life or potentially reaching a curative outcome. However, usually surgery by itself is just not enough. And the reason for it is, although it looks like a ball or a mass on imaging, it often has little fingers or tendrils that shoot out of it, almost like the tentacles from an octopus, if you will. And no matter how good the surgeons are, they just can't see those microscopic or small tentacles that come out of it. So they try to take the mass out cleanly, but there is usually potentially some left behind on the edges. And that's where sometimes other therapies become important. Usually when we're talking about cardiac angiosarcomas, in most cases, we like to try to provide chemotherapy to see if we can shrink the mass and potentially eliminate some of the smaller disease that can't be seen. Furthermore, angiosarcomas tend to be very aggressive cancers in general, and in many cases have already spread or become metastatic, even if we're not picking that up on scans. So the chemotherapy is given to try to address that as well. But surgery certainly plays a foundational role if it's possible. Chemotherapy, I believe, has a strong role in the treatment of it. And radiation is often considered if a surgery is done and there is disease left behind on the edges, so-called positive margins, or radiation can be considered if surgery isn't possible and it's important to try to control the mass. The difficulty with radiation is that it can also damage the heart, so it has to be done certainly very carefully.
You mentioned chemotherapy. What does that regimen typically look like?
The common agents that are used in sarcomas in general and angiosarcomas can involve several different types of strategies. Doxorubicin and ifosfamide are two agents that have been historically used in many different types of sarcoma and have some effectiveness in angiosarcomas. Another regimen that also has good activity involves two drugs, one called gemcitabine and one called Taxotere. Both of these agents seem to have independent activity in many angiosarcomas. So when they're used together, the theory is anyway that they would provide an even better result than either one alone. And then lastly, there's a drug called paclitaxel or Taxol, which is used commonly in breast cancer and has been used in angiosarcoma in the past in a well-accrued study. And this has some activity in angiosarcoma as well. The first two regimens that I described, the doxorubicin and ifosfamide, or gemcitabine and Taxotere, are certainly stronger regimens. They tend to come with more side effects. So if you are trying to treat somebody who might have a lot of weakness or illness from the disease and you don't feel it's safe to use such a strong regimen, paclitaxel is possible to give to hopefully affect an outcome and allow longer treatment or other treatment choices.
Are you typically trying to adapt regimens that have been successful in other sarcomas and use them for the cardiac angiosarcoma? There's not necessarily a regimen specifically for this disease.
Not necessarily. In other angiosarcomas in the body, paclitaxel is used, gemcitabine and Taxotere is used, and Doxil, which is another agent, can be used. In cardiac angiosarcoma, it is very important to try to do our best to obviously have a response to therapy, given the location of the tumor and the problems it can cause. So in that regard, the gemcitabine and Taxotere or the doxorubicin and ifosfamide, which are well-studied standard agents, so it definitely complicates matters, but we do have some strategies to deal with it to allow us to continue with other treatments.
What research is there in angiosarcomas in general? I'm sure it's difficult to do a trial specifically on cardiac patients, but what research is out there that you're excited to see coming in the near future?
One of our colleagues in sarcoma is leading a national trial in angiosarcoma. And you're right, it's not specifically designed for cardiac angiosarcoma, but it is designed for all angiosarcomas. And it is looking at comparisons between one of the drugs I mentioned before, this drug called paclitaxel or Taxol, to immune therapy. So immune therapy is certainly a well-studied strategy that has really changed the landscape of cancer treatment over the last decade or decade and a half. And it is being applied to different sarcomas now. So they're comparing paclitaxel to immune therapy for the treatment of angiosarcomas in general. And that may give us a new avenue of treatment. What's a little bit difficult here is that we do have some data showing that angiosarcomas, specifically of the head and neck area, seem to potentially be responsive to immune therapy. However, we're not really sure if the same thing holds in other areas of the body. So I think that will be important to find out, and certainly may open another avenue for therapy for this disease. Additionally, other research is being done looking at various changes in the DNA of many cancers, including angiosarcoma, to potentially try to find vulnerabilities. There's have not been any home runs yet, but that work is ongoing and will hopefully yield some fruitful results to help these people. So that's another area of research I'm excited to see develop.
I was doing some reading, and there was the idea that biologic agents, bevacizumab, sunitinib, sorafenib, may have some role to play in angiosarcomas. Has that been explored, and where is that research?
Actually, some of the agents you just described there, sorafenib, sunitinib, there's a cousin of that agent that's called pazopanib or Votrient. That medication is approved for the use in soft tissue sarcomas, including angiosarcomas. So that is another agent or strategy that can be utilized to try to control disease. The difficulty or a slight drawback of that medication is that it is more of a cancer stabilizer than a shrinker. So when you use that medication, in many instances, you might get the tumor to stop growing, but sometimes it's hard to get it to shrink. So those types of therapies are well-intentioned because often they try to attack blood vessel formation and blood vessel growth in general in tumors, and therefore have some utilization for angiosarcomas.
I know ASCO has made a big push this year to diversify clinical trials. With angiosarcomas, they're already a rare disease. Is it possible, or how do you diversify the study population when the population is so small?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And in general, the diversification of clinical trials becomes difficult because it's about access to medical centers. And I think one thing we need to do to a certain extent to think outside the box is figure out how to get people either into the centers where the trials are being done, or to figure out if there's a way to get the trials out to them if there are problems with resources just getting into the centers themselves. The NIH runs a lot of very specialized trials on rare diseases, and they do have resources to bring people in to help support travel and help support stay, because that becomes a big part of any clinical trial, just affording the various trips in and out of the centers and the parking and simple things like that. But part of it, I think, is also trying to engage community groups and patient advocacy groups to get the word out about the trials. In a lot of cases with these rarer cancers, and especially in sarcomas, there are a number of patient advocacy groups for almost every subtype of sarcoma. There is one for angiosarcoma, there's one for leiomyosarcoma and chondrosarcoma. So there are a number of advocacy groups out there, and they also help get the word out to people and try to connect them to clinical trials. So they become very important in helping to try to recruit patients to clinical trials.
on those same lines, how do you, you know, attract funding and attention for a disease that affects relatively so few people?
Very much to a certain extent outside the box. There are a couple of things that I think go on. The National Cancer Institute certainly has mechanisms for rare diseases. And yes, they're not as funded as well as some other more common cancers, but that is one mechanism. The advocacy groups, which I mentioned, do a really fantastic job of trying to raise funds to provide resources to investigators to start research or to do pilot projects, which I think are important. It is those sorts of, I think those sorts of campaigns that allow funding to be attracted. And at the end of the day, it's hopefully about the ideas and the science as well, that people agree that a particular idea holds a lot of merit, and that would hopefully move forward with good funding. But you're right, it is very difficult in what we'd call the rare disease space to move that needle, but a lot of people are working together to do that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Meyer, so much for taking the time out and speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this, Jason.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Christian Meyer, and thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Twitter, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.